I'm getting a lot of noise tonight. I don't know why. Yeah, on my own microphone.
You're getting a lot of noise? Like from us?
Yeah.
Oh, on your own microphone. It is kind of hanging there dangling.
This is not the microphone. This is the microphone. This is a headset piece that the kids have broken. Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm only using it for the earpieces, so. Don't have kids. They break stuff.
There's your outtake, Paul.
Is he recording?
That is recorded, yes.
All right. When do we do
the countdown?
Yeah, count us down, Andrew.
All right. 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Rampant Discourse Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Essen, and I'm joined by my regular contributors, Travis Hudson and Andrew Riley. We're still doing this remotely, so apologize in advance for any audio problems that we might have. Today is Wednesday, April 22nd, and we're going to talk about some of the media that we've been consuming lately. It's the second in our series of media consumption. We figured this could be something interesting to talk about, especially now when a lot of people are kind of confined to home and maybe looking for some new books, TV shows, other things to consume to entertain them. But before we start off, I just want to ask you guys, how are you guys doing? Do you have anything interesting going on in your lives that to share?
Well, since we last recorded about the coronavirus, I think the news broke probably as we were recording that we're now required to wear face masks when we're out in retail spaces. So I had to finally actually put one on to just go grocery shopping last time, which really drives home the post-apocalyptic Walking Dead atmosphere in a grocery store nowadays.
Nice. Andrew, how about you?
Well, I'd say the biggest thing that's been any significant change for me recently is that yesterday, 2 days ago, I was eliminated from the Great True Achievements Score Challenge for the year of 2019 to 2020.
My condolences.
It's a contest that I spent a lot of time and effort in, and being eliminated is both disappointing but also very liberating in that now I get time that I was pumping into that I probably shouldn't have been pumping into it back to do other things, which will be much more productive for me.
I was actually wondering, how crazy is True Achievements going with so many people likely home and getting more game time than they normally would?
I don't know that the site has changed any. They have the capacity to track that kind of stuff very fluidly for the number of people that they do track. Microsoft has definitely experienced some problems with their Xbox Live services, and they're not alone in this. I know PlayStation has as well, but I know much more about the Xbox ecosystem. There have been increased delays, more service problems, service outages. You can't download your titles as quickly or at all sometimes. You have trouble buying new titles, and the lag in multiplayer games is noticeably increased. But overall, except for a couple of periods right near the beginning especially, they've done a pretty good job of maintaining the service's integrity.
What about like just the number of achievement points people are earning at this point? Is that spiking in the graphs or anything?
I can't tell you that for certain because I don't know enough people in this. I do know that there are some people who have been able to score more. I do know that it probably has affected the competitions that people are in part of because, you know, they don't have that extra responsibility now. But the thing is, they might have been able to find a way to squeeze out this time and score those points anyway. It feels like it might be a little bit higher, but I don't think it's, you know, massively higher. It's not like a 100% increase. Maybe it's a 20% increase.
Hmm. Nice. So you can actually game for fun now instead of having to...
Yes.
Feel the pressure to game for not fun?
Well, gaming for different kinds of fun. I still have fun when I game for contests, but it's definitely a different kind of fun. It's exhausting, and I play games that aren't always the best. I have fun playing bad games, but I'm definitely going to spend some time playing games that are good games for more of my time now.
Like Gears 5.
Like which one?
Gears 5.
Oh, hell no.
Oh. Well, are you going to play Final Fantasy VII Remake?
We'll probably play that when it comes to Xbox. It's currently only being released to PlayStation, but they're going to have only, I think, 1 year of exclusivity. So in a year's time, when it comes to Xbox, I'll consider it. Final Fantasy VII is not my favorite Final Fantasy VII. Might actually be one of my least favorite ones. But it looks like they did a pretty good job with it. So
From what I read, though, it's like it's a 30-hour game, but it's only the opening of Midgar.
Yeah, it's basically the first disc of Final Fantasy VII, which was a 4-disc game. Right. You're going to spend your time in this remake first section entirely in Midgar. And when you exit Midgar, that's when you would exit the first disc of the PlayStation 1 version.
So I'm no Final Fantasy expert at all, and I guess possible spoiler alerts, but does that mean that the first disc ends with Aerith getting a sword in the back?
You know, I don't remember exactly when that happened, but I think that's probably going to be very close to that timeline, because she's a major part of it throughout all of Midgar, and she doesn't leave Midgar. So by the time you're finishing this this game, Aerith has passed.
So I have to ask, are you two fine gentlemen, are you Team Tifa or Team Aerith? Do you even know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
I understand the question. I just don't know if it's a question, right?
Okay.
I mean, I guess I'd have to say Tifa just because you wind up spending so much more actual game time with Tifa.
I thought this was a thing amongst the Final Fantasy.
You get to know her.
I've never heard of it, so. Oh. But again, Final Fantasy VII is not my game.
Okay, fair enough.
But generally speaking, I'm on Team Tifa. She's much more my type. I don't particularly find Aerith to be interesting or attractive.
The implication being that you find Tifa attractive.
Yeah, she's a buxy brunette. That's my type.
Let's say she does wear short shorts and a tight midriff shirt, so a lot of guys at that, especially the age we originally played the game at, would probably...
She's got these huge tracts of land.
Huge tracts of land.
Well, we're on a roll tonight.
All right, well, so if I apologize in advance if I'm in a little bit of a sour mood tonight. Strangely enough, social media has brought me down a little bit.
Really?
Shocking.
No, I mean, believe it or not, usually, like, there... We've discussed this in the past, but, you know, I've curated my Facebook and Twitter to the point where, like, there's usually just a lot of positivity on there, and it's not a lot that brings me down. But it's not just social media, to be clear. It's a combination of things. And really, I hesitate to mention any of them because all of them seem so kind of, like, tiny and inconsequential all put together. Or, I'm sorry, individually. But I think put together, they've just gotten me, like, a little frustrated. Like, there's just these stories about... the media loves to go on and get quotes from Abigail Disney. She's one of like the Disney heiresses. And as far as I can tell, she has not really accomplished anything in life other than having the last name of Disney. And yet CNN is constantly like interviewing her. And
she's not even Walt. She's like Walt's brother's granddaughter or something, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Exactly. So it's like she does, as far as I can tell, she has no standing to like have any greater opinion on the Walt Disney Company than anybody else, and yet she's very opinionated and she loves to point out how, you know, how terrible it is that whatever's going on, and you know, Disney is one of the holdings in the Freedom portfolio of Paul versus the Market, so I'm a little sensitive to all that criticism, so there's that. And then
are you more sensitive to the criticism than the stock is itself?
I think I am more so than the stock is. I don't think a lot of investors particularly care about what she has to say.
Obviously, this is not a logical response that you're experiencing, but consider that for a second, that the stock is not being moved by what she says, and yet you are.
I don't like it when people have stupid opinions.
What are you doing on the internet?
I know.
Especially social media.
What am I doing talking to you, Andrew? Oh.
I only saw one of her, or at least one story about one of her tweets. So maybe you saw other ones, because the one that I saw was she was complaining about all the furloughs, and yet all the VPs are getting their bonuses, which is actually very similar to a point people where I work had made of like, hey, can we get some sort of work bonuses for coming in and keeping your schedules for the bonuses that you guys are getting, and we're not getting anything extra out of it at this point.
And I guess the sad thing is that in this case, she may have some validish points, but she has such a history of grinding my gears and getting on my nerves, and she seems to express them in such a non-convincing way that it's just like, even if she has some good points to make, I'm immediately turned off by like the tone and tenor of her of her arguments. So, yeah, I mean, there is a point to be made that Disney paying a dividend right now when they have taken on a ton of debt to acquire Fox Studios, and where three out of their four major revenue generators in terms of theme parks and movies and whatever the other one I'm missing. Oh, sport, like ESPN. ESPN's viewership is incredibly down because a lot of sports aren't happening either.
Bowling's on the rise.
Yeah, I mean,
let's go bowling.
Yeah, I don't even know what joke to make there. But there's a lot of there's a lot of fair criticism to be made that they should not be paying a dividend right now. That they should, that executives probably should not be getting all these bonuses and whatnot. So I don't necessarily want to say that all of those expressed opinions are stupid, but it's just, like I said, seemingly inconsequential. The only other one I'll point out is there's this person, and Andrew might be familiar, I don't know, Brianna Wu.
The name sounds familiar, but I'm not placing her.
So I think she was one of the key figures in Gamergate, which was one of those things that I was never that knowledgeable about or involved in any way. But apparently she's running for Congress, I believe in Boston, Massachusetts, or some district up there. And over the past couple of days, she seems to have made it her mission to continuously call out libertarians about why they don't have a good response to coronavirus or some such, which strikes me as an incredibly strange strategy to win election, is to call out, to actively try and alienate admittedly a small segment of the voting population, but still voters, because it's not a good faith argument. She's made some cracks about apparently it was a joke about how libertarians are kind of secretly pedophiles or something, saying it was, if maybe libertarians, if it wasn't COVID-19, maybe if it was COVID-14, they'd be more interested in it, which I guess is some sort of jab at reducing the age of consent laws or anything, which I didn't get, but that's to give you an idea of the type of tweets she's sending out. And I'm like, dude, why are always people always trying to pick on libertarians? We have no power. All we want to do is be left alone. And yet everyone always wants to like be like, hey, look, see the government failing here? Like, this is all your fault because your worldview sucks. And I'm like, gah. So anyway, that's where I'm at mentally. So sorry if I'm more offensive and snippy than usual tonight. And with
bitter
that,
Paul is bitter.
Yes, bitter Paul is definitely bitter tonight. And with that, why don't we move on to what media we've been consuming? How about that transition?
What hasn't made you bitter?
What hasn't made me? Oh, that's good. I guess we shouldn't start with television then.
Uh-oh.
Because one of the things I've consumed has made me bitter. How about we start with books? Travis, I think you had some books that you wanted to share?
Yes. So, well, one thing I'll give, since we're talking about consumption, I'll give a shout out to Hysteria Brewing Company, whose beer I'm drinking, because they're still open. I figured I'd try to support the local companies.
I see what you did there, consumption. For the record, yes. I'm drinking Guinness, a decidedly non-local company and decidedly non-small business.
Yeah, there's, well, depends what you consider local. Guinness is right up the road for me.
It's local to the galaxy.
So I had my first experience reading a digital comic book, actually a digital trade book for Paper Girls for my library book club. It was written by Brian K. Vaughan. He's done Why the Last Man, Ex Machina, Saga. He's done a bunch of really big hits. He did Runaways.
Ex Machina, is that in relation to the movie?
I don't think it had anything relation, okay. Yeah. And it worked very well for digital because there was no like double page splashes or very intricate artwork. It was nice looking artwork, but it worked very well because I had to read it on my phone. And it actually worked out very well. The colors were bright, and it's a weird story. It's not about girls delivering newspapers. It is for like five pages, and then it's off the rails from that point. So that was good. It was interesting to do a virtual book club because they're using yet another platform, WebEx or something like that. I think
that's like Cisco or something, right?
Maybe. But like, so that was interesting. The pauses were extra pregnant when everybody's kind of staring like, all right, who's going to talk so we're not talking over each other kind of thing. The other book I've been reading was I bought it's an author called Isaac Adamson, and he wrote four books about a guy called Billy Chaka, and it's just this journalist guy that apparently he writes for a magazine called Euthanasia that's published out of Cleveland, Ohio, I think. But he spends all the novels in Japan, and rereading the first one, I remember why I got into it. It has a very Hunter S. Thompson-ish vibe, where he's kind of like he's this journalist, but he's getting in all these kind of wild hijinks adventures. The first one is Tokyo Sucker Punch, where he apparently has a proclivity for a geisha. So he's trying to track down this geisha, and it's tied up with like the Yakuza and a dead filmmaker and all this other stuff. So I've been enjoying that reread. I very rarely reread books. So for me to actually go back and reread something is a very rare occurrence.
Well, Euthanasia, you said that was a newsletter? What was that?
It's in the novel. The main character is Billy Chaka, and he is a journalist, and the paper he writes for is Euthanasia. So that's why he spends all his time in the novels over in Japan.
I was going to say, yeah, clearly I wasn't paying close enough attention, because I'm like, oh, that's an interesting name. And oh, the author writes a newsletter too. That's interesting.
Yeah, no. I have no idea if the author Isaac Adamson has written anything else. I've honestly never even bothered looking to see if he wrote anything outside of these four novels.
So that's the only two interesting books you've read lately.
So I was going to bring it up, though, when you were talking about libertarians in the news getting slammed, that I read your impactful book.
I only say that because you sent me an email about it today.
Yes, Economics in One Lesson.
Henry Hazlitt.
Henry, you can pull up my email comment where I was very complimentary, and I know I said it should be required reading for every high school student to actually learn the foundations of economics. I mean, it is, I think you admit it too, like, it is the lesson, and then chapter 25 is a restatement. And the intervening 24 chapters are basically, here's a bunch of examples of the lesson in action. But as he points out in the 30 years later chapter that he added for the update, no one learned the lesson in 46 when he first published it. Clearly, the number of examples didn't convince people or teach people well enough or something.
And at least some of them are useful to show like how often it shows up in like all various aspects of life. You know, it's not always just the obvious ones, but in some of the greatest issues of our time of the past couple decades.
And I did say in my Goodreads view, like, I learned more in those 200 pages about all the topics: taxes, wages, mm-hmm. price fixing, inflation, savings, unions, like everything about economics. I probably learned more about in reading those 200 pages than I did like even in that economics class I took at college, which was basically just a bunch of supply demand graphs.
Yeah, I took principles of microeconomics, I think, in college, and I feel like reading this book gave me probably three or four times as much knowledge as I got in that class.
So thank you for that impactful book. Go back and listen to the episode if you haven't listened to that podcast.
So now, do you have What Has Government Done to Our Money, or do you need to borrow that?
I have that. I also have the one about the Myers-Briggs test, I think.
Oh, please understand me. Yeah.
Although that one looks intimidating. It's kind of small print and feels like it's going to be very dense.
I think you'll have an easier time with that than you will with What Has Government Done to Our Money. Please Understand Me is an easy-ish read that I think might appeal to you more. What Has Government Done to Our Money is, there were certain pages that I had to reread like four or five times in order to understand, and I still don't know if I fully understood them.
And maybe just because we glossed over it at the beginning, I made the libertarian tie because Henry Hazlitt was a libertarian, at least according to his Goodreads bio. And at the end of the book, he calls out libertarians in a good way of like saying that they're the closest, I guess, to trying to proselytize the principles he puts in his book.
Yeah, I'm not sure how often he self-identified as such, but, you know, we'll take him.
Yeah, so those are the main ones. Other than that, I'm just trying to keep up with my comic book stack, because as the comic book shop owner said, all right, none of you have an excuse to be backed up anymore. You can't buy any new comics, so you better catch up on everything and be ready to go.
What else besides Batman?
So I bought like a whole bunch of Vault Comics. That's the publisher. It's called Vault Comics. They published a whole bunch of not really ongoing series. I think they have like one or two ongoing series. All the others are like basically five issues and done. So I've been reading through those, and the current one is called The Mall, which kind of has a Dawn of the Dead-ish feel to it, but there's no zombies in it. Not really. There's people that have lived underground, but they're not zombies.
The Mole Men?
All right, so Andrew, I think you had a book.
Yeah, so the big book that I've been reading was my Christmas present from my wife, which I've been spending some time reading recently, which is Neal Stephenson's Fall, or Dodge in Hell. Neal Stephenson is an author that people may have heard of already, but if you haven't heard of him, he does near future fiction, speculative fiction, science fiction, and brings a lot of big ideas in and then examines them in intricate detail. His books are 800 to 1,000 pages long most of the time, and usually very, very dense, full of material, and he really spends a lot of time unpacking those ideas. So the first two chapters are you're introduced to this character, Dodge, who is about to die. So the entirety of it is setting up the ideas that he wants to explore in the book about consciousness and how we think and how we are awake and what that's going to look like when Dodge is dead. And you can sort of see it happening, but it reads like, okay, this is like a very much down-to-earth slice of life of his life, except that he's not really what the story is about while also being the main character at that phase. So it's pure Neal Stephenson. He writes in a very particular style that I enjoy reading, but it's not for everyone. But if you like Neal Stephenson, this is a book that you're going to, I think, really enjoy as well.
So when I think of Neal Stephenson, I always think of Snow Crash.
Sure.
But Snow Crash and Diamond Age are kind of different books than like whatever the Quicksilver series or something was.
The Baroque and, Cycle.
Or even Cryptonomicon. Like Cryptonomicon was like the biggest book from him I read.
Yeah, Cryptonomicon is much more like what I've read, at least so far, of Fall or Dodge and Hell, because I think that's more like the style of book he wants to be writing these days. Snow Crash was what really brought him off the scene and shows a lot of his styles, but it's not where he's writing stuff right now, and Diamond Age is not near future, it's far future. But again, he's playing around with ideas. Most of this speculative fiction in general, science fiction in general, it's about the ideas. It's not about necessarily the story that you're telling. It's what can you do? What would be interesting about this? And then putting some characters into an interesting place where they can interact or be forced to interact with those things. And Stephenson does that in a very unique way. I think the author who might be the most similar in that sense, I'm blanking on his name. That was a bad transition.
I'll hop in and say, but because Snow Crash is, I mean, I would classify it as cyberpunk. Maybe it's not totally cyberpunk, but because that's my favorite subgenre of science fiction, that I'd read an article about how the modern our world has more turned into what the vision of cyberpunk actually was, or was it that, or was it the no? Actually, I think it was the opposite, because cyberpunk tends to have like a lack of government; everything's run by businesses and conglomerates, but the real world is more like politics are more controlling of everything.
Sounds like Jennifer Government to me.
Yeah, Max Berry was where I was going with that as well, with Jennifer Government, but also some of his other stuff. Max Berry, not a libertarian, but he understands libertarian ideas and writes with them in a fun way.
Yeah, I have no idea where I even read the article. It was something that popped up, you know, when you open a new tab and it has, here's articles you might like. It was one of those.
The author that I was blanking on is Werner Vinge, who has written things like Rainbow's End, which is a book that plays around with very, very big ideas in ways that you wouldn't expect it to. So similar kind of idea there, while also being relatively near future science fiction.
Did he write Fire Upon the Deep?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a cool book.
Yeah, he writes very interesting science fiction. definitely some of the hardest science fiction out there. And I think Fall is actually pretty hard science fiction, too. So the difference between hard science fiction and soft science fiction is hard science fiction is based on science and things that could happen and has these theoretical scientific backgrounds for where it's going to go from current technology into the new technology that the book's discussing. Whereas soft science fiction is like hand-wavy Star Wars type stuff, where it's like, oh yeah, it's the Force. It's almost like magic. We don't have to explain it. It's just this thing out there in space. And we're far enough in the future that it doesn't matter because it's we can make up anything we want.
It's funny, they literally wave their hand to do the Force too. I do have one quick Star Wars story that I finally showed Bruce, who is 7.5 years old. I finally sat him down and showed him A New Hope. And the scene I was most worried about, honestly, was the trash compactor scene. Because I figured that was like the scariest, you know, oh my God, they're all going to die type of scene. I had forgotten that he got scared by the same scene that scared me as a kid, is the cantina when Kenobi cuts off the guy's arm.
And that's even earlier in the movie.
And that's way in the movie. And like, and all you see is like, you know, you see like the guy saying, I don't like you either. And then like, vroom, psh, and you see the arm on the ground and there's like a little bit of blood. But he actually, I don't think he really had nightmares, but he was insisting we leave the lights on for a couple nights after that. And he kept saying he was scared of the arm. I was like, oh man.
Don't show him idle hands then. I'm not sure anybody's going to get that, but a select few.
I know Idle Hands.
I know of Idle Hands, but I don't think that anyone should watch it.
Oh, man. You're so wrong on so many movie opinions. All right, is it my turn for books?
Yeah, what you got?
Nothing nearly as grandiose? Grandiose?
Grandiose.
Grandiose. Whatever. See, J.K. Rowling once said that don't make fun of people for mispronouncing things because you know that they learned it by reading the word instead of...
Right, I wasn't talking. Making fun of you. I was just giving you the correct pronunciation.
No, you were making fun of me with your eyes. I can see it.
All right.
So I guess I got one in a tenth or so. I've read a couple more pages of Anti-Fragile. Man, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to finish that book. It feels like it's going to be a little bit like Economics in One Lesson in that I feel like I already get his point, and I'm not sure where the rest of the... however many hundreds of pages are going to go, other than to just like call out all the people that he hates and wants to make fun of. But we'll see. I'll give it some more try. By far, though, I've read a lot more of the Dealing with Dragons quadrology. We're on Calling on Dragons now. We finished up Searching for Dragons. I've been reading it to my girls. It's a book that I grew up with. So there's one more book left after this one. I don't know if there's much else to say. It was kind of like making fun of fairy tales before Shrek was making fun of fairy tales, and I'm sure other people made fun of fairy tales too. But when I was a child, it was like the first time that, you know, I read about the princess that did things that just wasn't proper. And, you know, yeah, it's a fun little series. My kids are enjoying it. The chapters are short enough. It makes a good bedtime story. So that's what I've been reading, is children's books.
So what's interesting about the twist, because I think you guys have mentioned that series before, is that you have to be familiar enough with the original to probably fully appreciate the twist they're putting on it, right?
Yeah, and I'm not certain my kids are getting a lot of it. It's a lot of it is certainly stuff that, and I'm not sure how much of it I got when I was a kid and I read it. They've run into Jack from not Jack from Jack and the Beanstalk. The giant from Jack and the Beanstalk is a character, and he's always complaining about all these Englishmen coming and stealing his geese or whatever it is. Rumpelstiltskin has made an appearance. I'm trying to think. I know there's others. I'm just can't think of it off the top of my head.
This is a series that I like very much as well, and I still am surprised to hear Paul's description of it as like these cracked fairy tales kind of idea. I mean, yeah, there's an element of it there, but I think that the story that they're telling is much bigger than just the cracked fairy tales, because yeah, you have a reference to Rumpelstiltskin, you have a reference to the giants and from Jack and the Beanstalk. It's clear that this is happening in that kind of a universe, and yet those are very much tertiary at best characters and situations. I think it's much different than what you're describing it as.
You're reading it wrong, Paul.
I don't think he's reading it wrong. I'm just surprised that that's how he's choosing to describe it.
I understand what you're saying. There is certainly a much larger world and a much more serious and maybe even epic struggle going on between the dragons and the Enchanted Forest and the Society of Wizards and everything else. But I guess to me, the tone throughout it is always one of subverting expectations and stuff like that.
That's definitely fair. The tone is subverting expectations.
Yeah, like pretty much everything is all about like, oh god, the stupid prince is always trying to rescue a princess from a dragon. For the first book, it's like pretty much every chapter has some sort of reference to like everyone rolling their eyes at the dumb princes who are trying to rescue princesses, and how the princesses are sometimes intentionally getting kidnapped just so they can get rescued by the princes. And it's a thread that goes through the other books as well. And I guess that's the kind of non-serious take that I don't know if it even appeals to me necessarily, but that I take it as it's a less serious book than the Harry Potter books, for instance. I think there's not quite a Prisoner of Azkaban kind of level of, or you know, Cedric Diggory just got murdered by Voldemort kind of thing. It's none of the good guys are ever in serious mortal danger. I'm understating it a little bit, but it's a less serious book, I think, or a less serious quadrology.
I think it's definitely intended for younger readers as well. One of the things that Harry Potter has going for it is that as a book of seven stories, as a series of seven books and stories, it's designed to be read one book per year, essentially, so the stories get progressively older because the characters in the books get progressively older. Whereas, for the most part, the Enchanted Forest Chronicles, you could read those all in a couple of months' time, and except for the fourth book, which is substantially later in time, they're all of a similar heftiness. They have the same kind of stories going on. There's not growing with the audience the same way. I do think that that is something that J.K. Rowling did that was perhaps uniquely hers, or at least substantially hers now more so than anyone else's.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I'm just trying to think, even in the quote-unquote youngest of the books, the first book, it basically starts off with Harry's parents getting murdered, which, you know, they kind of gloss over a little bit, and it's not dwelled upon, and there's nothing really frightening in the books that would turn kids off, but I can't think of anything in the Enchanted Forest quadrology that even comes close to matching that kind of darkness,
yeah,
I guess.
I would say that the Enchanted Forest's intended audience was probably younger even than the intended audience for Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone is intended for 10, 11-year-old children. And I'd say the Enchanted Forest Chronicles is probably aimed at 7, 8-year-olds for the most part.
And it's worth noting that my children are all younger than 10. So that's probably why I'm going with this instead of Harry Potter for now.
Yeah, which I agree is a good choice.
All right, so let's move on to TV shows. You guys have been watching any TV lately?
So yeah, we actually did, well, talk about what to introduce your young children to or not. The two shows we were watching were reality TV shows.
The Bachelor?
No.
The Bachelorette.
So one of them was, we've been watching the latest seasons of Top Chef on Hulu. So we finished that. And so we decided to go backwards in time, and we picked our daughter, I don't know why, she picked season 3, which happened to be when my wife and I started dating and started watching this show together. So this is kind of like a trip down memory lane for us of like watching this season again together, but with our children now this time. So that's pretty fun. Although we know who wins, but there's still the interesting, you know, there's like 20 some episodes to get to that point. So remembering all those is kind of fun.
It's funny you mentioned that because although we haven't watched it lately necessarily, my kids were on quite the stretch of enjoying MasterChef Junior, which is the Gordon. I don't know what, I'm not too familiar with Top Chef myself, but MasterChef Junior, it's a Gordon Ramsay. There's a couple judges and all the chefs are, I think, 11 or 12 years old or younger. They're all kids basically, And the kids, my kids, really loved watching them and being like, oh, wow, seeing what kids, a little bit older than them, but, you know, still kids, that more kids than adults, and kind of being impressed by all the cooking. And I haven't minded letting my kids watch that because I secretly hope that one of them becomes a chef because cooking is not my forte. And I would absolutely love it if my kids would grow up to be able to cook me very nice meals. That'd be great.
Arguably, we should be showing them that because it would also be much more appropriate for their age group. Because, I mean, Top Chef, I believe, is like on a 10 o'clock time slot on Bravo. So, and there's plenty of bleeping and plenty of, you know, relationship drama and everything. In fact, we actually were watching a different older season, I think season 10. And my wife and I were like, yeah, we should probably pick a different one because, like, there's some people on here that are having some, like, sexual tension drama that we don't, like, we couldn't remember how it actually kind of ended up going or anything. So we're like, yeah, it's going over the kids' heads, but it's kind of uncomfortable to watch it with, you know, a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old in a room.
That doesn't come up as much in MasterChef Junior.
No, there's, I mean, it was just comments like there's like a, I know the one guy's Scandinavian and the lady was Italian. And so the Italian lady's just like, she talks nonstops and she's very loud and everything. And the guy just makes a comment. He's like, you know, in his Scandinavian accent, which I won't try to, but it makes it even sound even better. He's like, you know, this is why I left Europe, European women. And I'm like, yeah, that's a joke that we can appreciate. I don't think the kids are appreciating that type of humor.
I will say one other show that my kids have watched a little bit and seem to enjoy is I'm not sure the exact name of it. I know there's a British version and an American version, but like the Great British Bake Off or something along those lines.
Yep. It's, I know that one, yeah. Actually.
Yeah.
So another possibility.
Yeah. So the one that was, but because of like some leeriness about general reality TV, I was worried about showing this other show that we did binge watch actually so that we could watch the finale, but we watched Lego Masters.
How was that?
So I was a little worried because I tried to read some reviews on it to see if it would be appropriate for them. There's not real drama or anything. Partially because they don't show you the like living in a house or anything like a lot of the shows do. The kids loved it because it's building Legos, and the things that these people create are amazing. Will Arnett is funny, although I think we appreciated his humor more so than the kids. Yeah, the people were interesting. There wasn't like a huge amount of drama. I mean, there was some drama. When I looked it up on Common Sense Media, which I know Common Sense Media's conservative slant. So what they mostly complained about was there's an older gay couple. There's a guy that on the first, at least one, if not couple of episodes, it's a guy wearing a dress and he has his hair French braided and has flowers in it. So they were distraught by that. They're like, think of the children. I'm like, that's the real world, people. Sorry. Like, so, but yeah, I liked it. It was really cool to see all the builds they made. So now Bruce has been building with all his Legos again.
So not to get us too off track, but I'm kind of curious a little bit. What are you looking for as a problem in these shows? Like what are you looking at? Is it language? Is it violence or sexual situations or something
are
else?
You about in reality TV, you mean? Or
just in general, like you said, you checked this website out and some of the complaints were this. What would have been a legitimate complaint in your eyes or something that was a legitimate red flag that you wouldn't have let your kids watch?
Well, so like, I guess maybe some of it is... is language, although I'm sure they've heard worse, honestly, from my wife. But I don't know, because I've gone back and looked at stuff like Karate Kid, and it kind of made me rethink about showing them that, or like Back to the Future, because the big thing with those things is they remind you, like, yeah, there was no PG-13 rating back when these movies came out. I kind of use it just as the starting point of like, what's a broad group of people think is appropriate age for this movie or this TV show. It seems more useful for movies than TV shows.
And just to be clear, absolutely no judging from me at all. I just more find it interesting because You talked about the guy in, what was it, dress and braided hair, you said, or yeah. whatever. And you said, well, that's just real life. And my thinking was, well, swearing, like, that's more real life to me than a guy in a dress and braids. Like, and it's interesting to see the different takes people have on raising kids, you know.
So, like, well, I'm not really answering your question about what I look for on the website, but one reason I liked the kids watching Lego Masters more than Top Chef was Lego Masters was, like I said, there's a little bit of drama, but overall it was way more positive than most reality, especially competition. Well, I can't even say that because I haven't watched non-competition reality shows, but like, because even on like Top Chef, like it's a competition. They're not purposely sabotaging each other, but like, they want to win. While as Lego Masters, yeah, they all wanted to win, but they were just as incredulous of each other's Lego creations as the judges were. So that was really cool to see. Like these competitors were able to appreciate each other. So that to me was a more uplifting message, I guess, for kids and, well, even for adults to be watching it instead of watching Real Housewives or whatever other reality shows are out there.
Yeah, I just for the record, like my kids, and they have a bit of a potty mouth, and you know, it's probably my fault because I'm not quite as panicked about that. If we're watching something and someone says a swear word, I'll just kind of look at them and be like, "Don't say that." And obviously, kids aren't going to listen to me, so they pick it up and surprisingly they get the context right a lot of times. I'm surprised by how effectively they swear sometimes. It's usually in a well-timed swear word, and I'm like, that's kind of funny, don't do that again. Yeah. And
like, there was just something about that one season of Top Chef that we kind of switched away from, because I mean, like I said, we had watched at least two prior seasons with them, like current seasons, and we're watching the third season and fine with it, and there's still cursing, there's guys from New York going at each other, calling each other out and everything. But for some reason, it's the vibe feels a lot different than like that other cast was. The other cast was much more abrasive.
Andrew, do you have any TV shows that you've been watching, or has it all been GTASC?
Amazingly, I actually have watched television, which is unusual for me because I don't usually watch a lot of television. But the last time that we got together and had this conversation, Gerke recommended a show called The Genius, which is a Korean reality TV show, a South Korean reality TV show. And so I went and started watching that, and I have completed watching the first season. And so I can agree, it was pretty good. I'm not a huge fan of reality television, but it's one of the things that does tend to get to me. I remember that one Sunday in college, I turned on the television while I was doing laundry, and Comedy Central was showing the entire season of this comedian search reality TV show that I can't remember the name of. And
Last Comic Standing.
Last Comic Standing, that's it. Yeah. And I just watched the entire season while I did laundry that day. It can grip me if it's the right thing. Survivor, don't care about it in the least. But The Genius game got to me as well, because it is interesting. You have interesting personalities, smart people doing interesting things in a very gamified situation. So it was a lot of fun to watch. And I think that it was also good for me because it helped me to find out a little bit about South Korean culture more than I had already. It's different enough from other cultures that I'm already familiar with to be interesting and new, while also similar enough that I felt right at home in it.
I like how you specify, I think you initially said it was a Korean, then you said South Korean, because we all know that if it was a North Korean drama or a reality show, it would just be Kim Jong-un winning every single season.
Right, if he was allowed to participate, you know, it'd be his stand-in winning every other time otherwise. But yeah, it's obviously South Korean because they can actually produce a reality television show. They have a prize pool of hundreds of millions of won to actually do this with, rather than, you know, the prize is you get to eat next month.
They can also make coronavirus test kits. That's right, Maryland.
So do I even want to ask about if you were able to watch it legally or the quasi-legal way that Gerky was suggesting last time.
Well, Gerky sent me a link, but all of the links were
essentially... He just implicated Gerky in this.
Yes, congratulations. But all the links were essentially going right back to sources from YouTube. So it does look like it's available on YouTube. It's just that this was the way that she found it. So if you are interested in watching it, you can probably find it on YouTube.
All right. Any other TV shows for you all?
So wait, on YouTube, would you just search for The Genius?
Yeah, I'd say The Genius and then add in like Korean reality TV show, because otherwise you're going to get a lot of other hits from Genius. It's not a unique enough word. Right.
But it's considered a reality show.
It's a reality show.
Not a game show?
It is kind of a game show, but I would call it a reality show.
Okay.
All right. So my TV shows are pretty Star Trek heavy in that they're only Star Trek shows. My wife, as mentioned last time, was going through Star Trek The Next Generation. My eldest daughter absolutely loves watching pretty much anything on TV. And so she caught my wife watching them sometimes, and she's like, I want to watch. And I told her, Mama's watching this right now, but I'll tell you what, you and I and your sister, we'll watch the superior Star Trek show, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, sometime. And that time has come, and we've started watching that, my two daughters and I. And it is pretty clearly too early in their development for me to be showing them this show. There's a lot of stuff going on in that show. There's shades of gray going on. There's not good guys. And a lot of the common questions that came up are, is that a good guy? Is that a bad guy? Because one of the neat things about Deep Space Nine is that there aren't a lot of pure good guys and pure bad guys. There's a lot of generally good people who do bad things and generally bad people who sometimes do good things. And so there's not an easy answer to a lot of these questions. Additionally, there's a lot of world building going on. Like very early on, you learn about the Bajorans and their religion and their history with Cardassians and with the Federation. And then there's, in the very first episode, there's a wormhole that takes you to the Gamma Quadrant, which is a whole unexplored sector of space. And every other episode or so, there's a new species showing up that you have to learn about. And there's a lot of geopolitical intrigue and whatnot. So there's been and additionally, the wormhole aliens are non-corporeal, who don't understand the concept of time, which these are all kind of mind-blowing concepts introduced. They were mind-blowing concepts for me when I first started watching the show. I can only imagine what they're like for young kids to be consuming them now. But they seem to be enjoying it. So we're maybe about a quarter of the way through the first season right now. And we'll probably keep watching maybe two or three episodes a week and keep on going with that. So I'm having a lot of fun with that. There's a lot of nostalgia factor. Surprisingly, the episodes hold up pretty well. There's a little bit of sketchy CG and it's a little bit corny at times, but honestly, the dialogue, the character development, and a lot of the plot still kind of holds up to this day. So I've been enjoying that. The second TV show is Star Trek Picard, the CBS All Access original, where they revisit Captain Picard's life in the 20, 30 years since the end of The Next Generation. And that I have, this is where Bitter Paul comes back, I guess. I have less complimentary things to say. It wasn't awful, but I didn't really enjoy it all that much. It seems to suffer from a lot of the same issues that I have with Star Trek Discovery, which is another recent Star Trek TV show, which I watched the first couple episodes and then kind of got bored of. They seem to be trying too hard to make a show that's not really Star Trek. And they seem to be trying too hard to make it dark and have all these twists and turns. And listen, I think Deep Space Nine is the greatest Star Trek series so far, and that's a very dark series. I don't mind dark in my Star Trek, but like when you first meet like this new captain, he inexplicably has a shirt off and has like this piece of metal embedded into his shoulder. No explanation whatsoever. They're just trying to make him seem like a badass because he somehow got metal embedded in his shoulder. And the first time we meet another character, she's smoking and clearly an alcoholic and drinking herself into oblivion. And these are things that you don't often see in Star Trek. So it felt like they were just trying to do these weird things to try and be like, oh, look how edgy and dark we are. And they would bring back these characters from other series, Star Trek Voyager, Star Trek Deep Space, or Star Trek Next Generation, but they would have them be portrayed by different actors, and then they would bring them back only to, kind of, spoiler alert, kill them off for like a cheap shock value. There wasn't even any like time spent mourning their losses or anything like that. And I don't know. It was a little bit of a disappointment. It was kind of fun to revisit that world. Like, we haven't really had a Star Trek series set in the normal Star Trek timeline. Like, the J.J. Abrams movies have been in an alternate universe. Voyager was off in the Delta Quadrant. It hasn't been since Deep Space Nine that we've actually visited the regular Star Trek timeline. And it's kind of interesting to see how things have gone with the Romulan star having gone supernova and everything. But I don't want to get too deep into like the plot, but I don't know. It felt like, all I can say is it felt like they were trying too hard. They kind of smashed in the Borg, which there's a Borg cube that kind of ultimately didn't need to even be there. It wasn't integral to the plot. And a lot of the plot seemed stolen from Mass Effect, which is a video game that I love. And it just felt a little too on the nose. It was just a little bit of a disappointment. So I don't want to go on griping too much longer, because I feel like probably nobody listening really cares. But, got to stay on brand and be Bitter Paul tonight.
Or has CBS All Access.
They've been actually offering a lot of free trials lately. I don't think I paid any money for... I think I was able to watch all of Star Trek Picard without paying any money. I was able to get a free trial, and then when I went to cancel halfway through the series, because it hadn't hooked me yet, they said, oh, wait, we'll give you another free month. And sure. And then I was able to watch the rest of the show. So
do you think
that worked out great?
That the disappointment in Star Trek Picard is due to them trying too hard or going in this direction that isn't particularly good? Or is it perhaps that there are no more interesting stories to tell in a Star Trek-like universe? I don't think that, a good writer couldn't find something, perhaps, but an entire series about a character who's already had a series, or this world and universe that has had so many movies and series in it, is there enough new ground that they could have really come up with something new and flashy and interesting without going in a completely different direction?
That's a good question. I suspect there should be, I think. The Star Trek has always been at its best when it tries to use science fiction to address kind of more current and modern issues. And I feel like they tried to do that a little bit there was a little bit of, kind of refugees and we should be taking in refugees kind of thing. And thankfully they didn't dwell on that too much. But I don't know. It didn't feel like they tried, I guess. It felt like they were trying to just make it like there were no overarching themes that really stood out to me. Where Star Trek is at its best is I feel like they're trying to struggle with some key issue that we're struggling with currently. And that wasn't the case. It was just, hey, let's shove in some action here and throw in a cheap death here and a cool decapitation here and a Romulan Legolas there. And it's just, I don't know. It felt like it was weird, because it felt like the showrunners didn't really grasp what made Star Trek special. And yet they clearly knew their stuff, because they had a lot of deep references that only a really true Star Trek fan would get. So I don't know. I'm not sure where it went wrong.
And I would think you'd be able to tell any number of stories in a Star Trek universe, or since I'm more of a Star Wars fan, in a Star Wars universe. I mean, how many novels? Well, Star Trek has had just as many novels probably as Star Wars has had at this point.
But how many of them are good?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the point. I guess for Star Wars particular, I'm thinking, I mean, how much praise was heaped on The Mandalorian? So it's more like you find something that was there but was unexplored. To your earlier point, like Picard already had however many seasons of Next Generation and however many movies he was in to explore that character. Would it be better to have picked some side character that wasn't, you know, was in one episode or something?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the problem was with Picard himself. I think there were still stories that could be told with him. It's interesting because, one of the main plot lines in Star Trek Picard kind of ties back to a Next Generation episode called The Measure of a Man, where basically Starfleet was trying to determine whether Commander Data, Lieutenant Commander Data, who was an android, basically was a sentient being that was worthy of rights or not. And it was one episode dedicated to that where basically they came down to, yes, he is a sentient being that deserves some degree of rights. And I felt like there's a lot more ground that you could cover there in terms of, you know, well, exactly how much rights and the Picard was all about more how synthetic beings basically ended up getting outlawed, and what are the implications of that, and what are the, whether that's morally right or whatnot. And the series itself didn't really dig into it all that much. I felt like they were dealing with the consequences of that decision more so than struggling with the ideas that led up to that decision. And to me, that was a little disappointing.
That's a very interesting distinction, Neo, between the ideas that put you in a place versus the consequences of decisions that have already taken place. The fact is that these decisions already took place, and so therefore there's less interesting story to tell. You know, the choices have been made.
Exactly. It felt like, yeah, we picked up after a lot of the interesting stuff that happened, and I guess that was a little bit of a disappointment. So, anyway, that's my... Hopefully that's the end of the bitterness for now for TV shows. I think that leaves us with games as our final category. So, Travis, do you have any particular games that you've been playing?
So real quick, I'll just throw out that we started playing through all of our Game Right games recently. That's why I wrote the article for the website that Paul just said actually got liked by the publisher itself, apparently. So I guess either they liked the publicity or they thought I did a nice write-up for their games.
Only the second one, to be clear. Your first one sucked, apparently, according to Game Right.
But I originally wrote this list down last week, and I wrote down the two games we were playing the most right now were Frog Juice and Loot. We haven't actually played Loot since then, so I guess I'll strike that from the record of being in our rotation. But Frog Juice is now a nightly game. And even our five-year-old doesn't fully grasp the strategy or that, but even she knows enough to like be able to like know what cards to play. It's teaching her the rudiments of math, because one of the mechanics is you can trade in two cards that add up to a third card to collect them all and stuff like that. So that's been kind of a nightly thing now. Going back to my other topics of scaring my son with Star Wars, apparently, and traumatizing them with Top Chef drama, we played the game Horrified, which is based on
that. Sounds like a terrible idea.
Well, so it's a cooperative game. It's based on the Universal monsters. So you're battling Dracula, Mummy, Invisible Man, Wolfman. We battled Dracula and Invisible Man. And I already told you guys the story, but yeah, so then we won. We won pretty handily, actually, considering it was just the two of us. It was our first time playing, but they're the two easiest monsters to fight. And yeah, that night he tends to have night terrors where he's having a nightmare. He appears fully awake, but he is not awake. Like, his eyes are open and everything. And apparently he was trying to keep the Invisible Man out of his room while he's screaming and we're trying to comfort him, even though he's asleep. So, yeah, that's up on the shelf then for a little while, I guess, because to not go down that path anymore. I mean, I liked it.
I don't know if it necessarily deserved all the praise I had read heaped on it. It is a nice alternative to something like the other cooperative games we have, like Castle Panic or Pandemic, which some people don't even want to play Pandemic nowadays because it's too on the nose, I guess. But yeah, those were the... And then the last one that recently just started hitting the table is Carcassonne, which is a classic game, obviously, but I just recently introduced it, and that's been getting heavy rotation now, too, which I don't even know if we need to explain Carcassonne.
I think it's...
Is it Carcassonne or Carcassonne Jr.?
Regular Carcassonne.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, Gerky's talked up the Jr. version. I felt like we kind of had that, because there's a Game Right game called Legend of Landlock, which is basically Carcassonne. Like, you're matching up water to water, grass to grass, road to road, and there's scoring for putting gnomes facing each other and all that. So I felt kind of like, we've already played that. He's definitely ready for Carcassonne. I haven't tried it with my five-year-old. I think she would be more appropriate for the Junior edition.
I love that we're at the point where Carcassonne or Settlers of Catan are classic games now, because they are. You're absolutely right. But, you know, it shows, I think, how far board games have come, that we can consider that when those games were so instrumental in changing how we thought about board games.
Well, we're also old, because, like, Ticket to Ride is 16 years old at this point.
Yeah, we are officially old, guys. I realize that. But at the same time, it does feel good to know that these are classic games.
Well, it's also, and one tiny correction, it's only called Catan now. They dropped Settlers of.
Well,
I don't know if that...
When I was playing it was Settlers of Catan, and that's how we liked it.
But one big deal is, like, you go into Target, and Catan, Ticket to Ride, I think Carcassonne, like, all these games are Pandemic, all these games are on the shelves right next to Monopoly and Risk.
And Chutes and Ladders.
So, yeah. So it's definitely showing a shift.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting to see how board games have gotten... Board games and video games, both gaming in general, has just gotten more mainstream acceptance during our lifetimes, which is pretty cool.
The only thing I wasn't sure about, maybe you guys have more experience playing Carcassonne than I did, it comes with a scoring, like a little map kind of thing, I guess, that has 50 spaces on it to keep track of your score. We routinely lap that board like 3 times. So I don't think we're doing the scoring wrong, but I'm just like, 50 points seems like a really low score.
I'll be honest, I've never played regular Carcassonne, I'm sorry, I probably have, but it's only like, I could probably count it on one hand how many times I've played, so I'm not sure if there's an easy miscalculation you can do with scoring, or if maybe it is legit that you just circle it a couple times.
Yeah, so we've had to take like things like, because you use one of your meeples to keep track of the score, so we've had to do stuff like, well, your second time around, we put them face down. Like, we knock them over. Oh, well, we went around another time. Quick, get another different colored meeple to indicate you're on your third time around the board. And feels like maybe I'm not calculating the score right, but I don't...
Yeah, I don't know. It's been too long since I've actually played Carcassonne in any way, but I seem to recall playing games where the scores were 150 points. So a 50-point board, you could hit 3 times, and that would not be unreasonable.
Yeah, because, like, I mean... A cloister is 9 points if you get it fully, and like cities, as long as you're building them right, can be like
huge points.
It can be like especially because we're getting too deep into one game now, but he like pulled off a trick of putting two knights in the same city because they were in two different cities, yep. And then he connected it into one, and he got like 60 points from one city, and I was like, oh my gosh.
Well played.
I think that's the one game he's won. I think I have routinely won, because...
Humble brag.
Well, I don't think he's quite grasped, like, the long game of, like, specifically farmers. I don't think he's really grasped the key way of getting farmers, and, like, you don't get the points until the end, but you can get, you know, you can easily get 30-40 points just from farmers if you connect them right. Yeah, so those are the Frog Juice and Carcassonne are the games in heavy rotation, and we just played our first game of Onitami, so I can't really talk about it, but we liked it.
Before we move on to Andrew, I just have to say that Frog Juice sounds like an absolutely disgusting name for a game.
So actually, in my article, it was one of the ones that I forgot we actually didn't recall ever playing it. So like, I originally, when I wrote the article, that was my statement. I was like, I don't remember this game. Moving on. And then I pulled it out to play it to give it its due, and yeah, it leaped to the top of the stack.
I see what you did there. Frog leaped. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Andrew, how about you? You haven't. Yeah, I heard that you haven't been playing anything lately.
Oh yeah, you know me. I don't have time to play games. No, yeah. I have two I'm going to talk about, but I'll try and keep it fairly quick. The first I'm going to talk about is yet another classic. I have been returning to Magic the Gathering. Not playing it a ton, as in, you know, playing matches. A little bit here and there with some online play with Magic the Gathering Arena, or playing with my kids, continuing to teach them and improve their skills and such, or doing limited events. I like to play pack wars with them, so I have some unopened packs and would pull out the pack, shuffle it into a stack of lands, and just play the pack like it's a deck. So random fun. But spending a lot of time in quarantine going through my old collection of cards to organize it and build new decks and sell some cards, etc. So I've gotten the Magic the Gathering bug again, and I expect this will fill up the time that I hadn't put into G-Task.
So did you play Magic Arena? You
said? A little bit, yeah. You said? Just a little bit.
So, and I don't know if it's exclusive to that or not, but I literally just heard about this on a Dice Tower podcast from last September, but there was a Throne of Eldraine. I don't know if you know that one or not.
Yeah, I think that expansion. That's the set that came out two sets back.
It's Fairy Tales, though. Yes. So if you had played it, I was curious what that actually entailed.
I think I actually went to the pre-release for that one. I still do pre-releases periodically because my local game shop holds pre-releases that I can get to, and it's a fun way to play the game and get to introduce the set and the new mechanics. That set had some alternate art on cards, and the alternate art cards were absolutely gorgeous. There's a style of art for Magic the Gathering cards now, which is very high quality. You know, Wizards put together a very good product here, but it's lost a little bit of its artisticness as it's gone for more realism and for some grittiness. So these alternate art cards sort of harken back to the way Magic used to look, while also being like really beautiful paintings in a lot of ways, and fairy tale style paintings. So those pieces, I brought one home, and it was a fairy, and it was obviously fairies make sense, it's in blue for Magic, so it's a blue fairy. My wife's favorite color is blue. She loves fairies. It's like, this beautiful piece of art, this card, this is for you. I won this card, it's yours. It's a little trophy. And it was just a nice little gesture. So yeah, that was a fun set. I recommend that one. They are doing a current set that is basically Godzilla and the others. Not Geisha, because that's...
Kaiju,
thank you. Why was I blanking on that word? Again, we got all the kaijus going. You said geisha
and kaiju are so similar. I can see how you guys confused.
Travis said geisha. It was stuck in my head.
I want to see a combination. I want to see like geisha, kaiju. Geisha. Yeah,
I'm sure that would be terrifying.
Godzilla and kimono.
So if you, I guess I'm just curious, in the current circumstances, how are you playing Magic?
With my kids, so we're stuck at home, and I have plenty of product, and, you know, I've got thousands upon thousands of cards that we can just randomize and throw into decks if we want to, or build decks out of, or online with Arena and stuff, so I'm not actually interacting with people. I don't think that my local game shops, either of them, the ones that are close by, have shut down, actually, because one's a comic shop and the other as well, and I went by early on in the quarantine to see if they were closed, and they had a sign saying, nope, we're open, and we'll stay open as long as we can, but maybe they've been shut down now, maybe they had to close, or maybe they decided they weren't getting enough business and they had to shut down. But people working in those kinds of industries, you know, if you're the owner of a shop like that, you shut down, you're not making any money. you don't have any money to support your staff. You don't have any money to support yourself. So it's not something they want to do lightly.
Yeah, I actually emailed like my comic book shop, my game shop, to just ask them like, hey, is there, short of just giving you money, is there anything we can be doing? Because I had heard stuff like some game companies, like publishers, were, if you bought it through their site, you could like fill in a form to say, I would have bought it from this game shop, and they'll give some money to that game shop, even though the bulk is still going now straight to the publisher.
But yeah, it's better than nothing. I don't know about that situation. I don't know my owners of the LGSs, the local game shops, well enough to ask those kinds of questions. And I haven't driven by since early on in the quarantine to either one of them. But the last I saw, they were still open, and I never gave them a whole business. I never gave them a whole lot of business to start with, but I have thought about going by and making sure they got some of my business now, just to help them out in this rough time. So Magic the Gathering, very much still a fun game, continues to evolve in fun ways, continues to surprise me, and continues to hold value. Some of the cards I'm digging out of my stuff is like, how much is this thing worth? This can't be worth anything. Oh, wow, this is worth a buck. Cool.
That was an story.
Well, you know, considering it's a common, and I have 8 copies of it, you know, it's...
You have $8?
Yeah. Well, considering that I was expecting it to be a penny, if that, that's a that's 100% increase. Or not... Not a 10,000% increase. It's a huge increase.
Yeah. No, it's like when I went through all my comic books to see if anything was worth anything. It's like cover price. Well, I guess technically they've gone down in value because of inflation, but otherwise they've just held their value.
Yeah, you did pretty well, honestly. The other game that I've been playing a ton recently is called Slay the Spire. Slay the Spire is a single-player roguelite deck-building game. So imagine that you're playing a game, something like Dominion, where you're drafting cards and you get a choice to add a new card to your deck, essentially after every combat, and you're using your deck to fight against enemies that are controlled by the computer in a ever-progressively more difficult climb to the top. And it's just incredibly well designed. And I've liked Slay the Spire. I've been aware of Slay the Spire for a long, long time. I knew I was going to like it when I played it. But I hadn't ever actually played it. I didn't give them money. I didn't buy a copy. It just was on my radar, but wasn't something I had time to play. But it ended up in Xbox Game Pass, and they put achievements on it. And I was like, oh, yes! Now I can play it and earn achievements. Now I can play it for real and have a great time. And each run of Slay the Spire takes me, because I'm still fairly new to the game, despite having spent a lot of hours on it, an hour to an hour and a half to go through. And I'd say 30 or 40% of those times I'm losing. And it feels great. I don't know any other game where I can have this much struggle with the randomness and still be enjoying it. It's really remarkable.
You had me at Game Pass. You said, is it still available on Game
Pass?
Still
available on Game Pass.
Slay the Spire. All right, I might give it a try then.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. At least to try it, especially since you don't worry about the completions the way I do. Give it a try, play the Ironclad, beat it at least... beat the first boss with the Ironclad, or get to the point where you unlock the Silent, which is the second character, and give the Silent, I think the Silent is the most interesting of the characters, a couple of playthroughs, and if that hasn't gotten your attention, then that probably isn't for you by that point, but I think you're going to really enjoy it.
Alright, thanks for the recommendation. My turn?
Yeah, what you got?
Alright, so I have 3 games, and I want to see if you all can tell me what they have in common. So I just, last time I think I mentioned Indivisible was a, I suppose the term is Metroidvania type game, although that's a little bit of a simplification because there's also some kind of quasi real time, quasi turn based combat. But I actually ended up beating that game. And now I'm alternating between Celeste, which is kind of a platformer type game, a platformer puzzle type game maybe, and a quirky game that I frankly had never heard of called Shantae the Half-Genie Hero.
Oh, I've heard the character, I think.
Oh, okay. I had never heard of it. And the thing that, so beyond the fact that they're all available on Game Pass, any thoughts on what they might have in common?
I don't think Celeste is available on Game Pass. That was a Games with Gold.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that's what it was. It was an older game that I had. There's probably a lot of things they have in common, honestly. But the thing that
female stuck out to me is
that they all have female protagonists, which I don't think was intentional on my part or anything. But it is notable that I have been playing this with my daughters. I've been spending more time with them because we're all at home now a lot more than we were before. And so some evenings, and even some mornings, we'll begin or end the day with me playing a video game, and they very much enjoy watching me play. Every once in a while, they'll want to give it a try themselves and, you know, end up dying a lot over the course of just a couple minutes. But they largely seem pretty content to watch me play a lot of these games. And it seems like, I'm guessing that they probably lean a little bit more towards the ones with the female protagonist. I'm not sure. It seems like more than a coincidence, considering how often usually video games have a male hero involved, that these three that I've been playing just happen to have a female hero. But they've been fun. They're pretty lightweight. I don't know if I'd necessarily, if you're looking for something easy to just kind of and fun to play, then sure, go for it. None of them are ever going to crack my top 50 games of all time, because there's nothing super special about them, but they're nice because it's something, it's not overly complicated like an XCOM or something where I have to explain all the various rules about weapons and armor and turns and special abilities. It's very intuitive to grasp, so my girls understand, oh, jump and dash, and that's all you need to know for a lot of this. Or jump, dash, and attack, I guess. And it's enjoyable to watch, which is pretty important because it's serving as entertainment for both me and my daughters. I've beaten Shantae the Half-Genie Hero. It was fine. Indivisible, fine. I know these aren't glowing reviews, but what can I say? I guess it's just bitter Paul talking. I had fun while playing them. And currently working on Celeste, which is a little bit harder, it's nice to have that challenge. And I think my girls actually enjoy it. The more I die, I think the more they have fun because they like, making fun of their dad for dying. I'd be like, Daddy, you should have jumped there. You shouldn't have fallen into the spikes. Did you know that the spikes kill you? I'm like, yes. Yes, I know that. Trust me.
So I have a very important question for you, Paul.
Uh-oh.
Are you playing Celeste with assist mode on?
I don't think so. Although, I will say, I started playing it, and I saw there was an assist mode. And then I did start a new game for one of my daughters with assist mode on, and she only played like the first half of the first level. I didn't notice any difference. So I'm actually kind of confused as to what assist mode does.
It's a little bit complicated because first you have to turn it on and then you tweak it to assist you to the amount that you want. So you can do a lot of things within assist mode to make the game a little bit easier or a lot easier.
Okay. I don't think I have it on right now. I certainly haven't, if I did have it on, I haven't done anything to tweak it. And I haven't noticed any questions about like, oh, do you want to make this easier? Do you want to make this harder? So I'm guessing I don't have it on in the game that I'm playing, but I'll be honest, I don't know. So whether that makes me a failure in your GTSA, whatever, mind.
In terms of, you know, the points are the same regardless. You earn the achievements whether the assist mode's on or off, and that actually upsets some purists because they want the assist mode to turn the achievements off. It doesn't. So, if you want to play the game, you should play the Celeste is one of the better platformers that's been released recently, especially as a pure platformer.
I think I've touched on this before, but I'm certainly at the stage of my life where I'm not super interested in the original Nintendo Ninja Gaiden kind of you play a level for hours and hours and hours to memorize exactly when to press a button kind of challenge anymore. In fact, One game that didn't make this list is Ori and the something
Will of the Wisp?
Something Forest.
Ori of the Blind.
Not the Will of the Wisp.
The first forest one. Ori and the Blind Forest. Okay.
Yeah, the Blind Forest. The Definitive Edition, which is, I'm pretty sure that one's available on Game Pass. Seems like a super, a very beautiful game, and my girls really enjoyed it, and I think they actually enjoy it more than Celeste. And maybe it could even be a better game, I don't really know. But I got annoyed by the fact that I kept on dying, and save points, you have to like spend energy for save points or something along those lines. And so as a result, I wasn't saving very often.
Mistake.
And by like the third or fourth time that I had to replay like the entire half of a world, I'm like, ugh, this just isn't enjoyable. Like unlike you, Andrew, I don't play games to like be frustrated and or I play games to have fun, solely to have fun, not to like get achievements, not to like play bad games or anything like that. I just want to enjoy myself, and having to get frustrated and replay these same sections over and over again, I'm basically out. There's plenty of other games to play.
A question for you on Ori and the Blind Forest. Did you make it to the tree?
I think so.
If you made it to the tree segment, you have to, after you get into the tree, eventually you have to outrun a flood in the tree. Do you remember that?
So I got to the main tree, and I think he said that I had to go to like the water tree next.
Yeah, okay.
Or something like that. So I haven't gotten to, I didn't have to outrun the flood.
Outrunning that flood is widely regarded as the hardest part of the game.
Okay, so no, that I didn't even get to that part yet. And for the record, that's one other thing that kind of annoyed me and was maybe one of the straws that broke the camel's back. I have no idea what's going on in that story. Not a clue. And they spend a lot of time telling me this story, and I'm just getting more and more confused the more they tell me about it. And so, you know me, I don't like things that don't make sense, and I'm just completely and utterly confused with what's going on, which is not a point in the game's favor.
So, Ori and the Blind Forest is a platformer, but it's a Metroidvania. Indivisible is kind of a Metroidvania. But Celeste is a pure platformer. It doesn't have abilities except for your special strawberry dashes, basically. So are you finding the simplicity of Celeste more to your liking?
Well, so it's interesting because Shantae, I would say, is more of a Metroidvania.
Shantae is also a Metroidvania, yes.
You get abilities which unlock other areas. I think I'm fine with either. I don't think there's necessarily... Sure, the simplicity of Celeste is kind of nice. I just think it's the little things with Ori, and that's kind of annoying me. Like the fact that it's hinting at some sort of grand story that's meaningful and emotional, and which means nothing to me. And the fact that it's with Celeste, if I die, whatever. Like I come back to life, like at worst, like one screen back or something like that. In Ori, I've already died like four or five times where I'm like, oh god, now I have to spend the next 15 minutes replaying what I just did because I didn't want to spend my precious energy to create a save point because I need to use this energy to open a door somewhere. And it's interesting. I don't understand why people add these game mechanics which seem to serve no purpose other than to frustrate. And I'm just not all about that right now in my stage of life.
I have a video I'm going to send you offline. Maybe we'll put it in the show notes, but it's Seamus Young, who is a commentator and video game designer himself at this point, and a writer and such, and talking about game mechanics and how they punish us sometimes. Maybe that's not the way we ought to be looking at games.
In terms of how designers shouldn't be looking at, or how we shouldn't be looking at?
What is game difficulty? Is game difficulty the experience that you had to overcome a challenge, or is game difficulty that you failed at the challenge that the game put in your way, and then it made you track back so far to take another crack at it, even though the challenge itself maybe isn't all that hard? The hard part is that it makes you do the whole thing over again. So if the requirement is that you do a sequence of 100 things, you can do each of those things 99% of the time, you're still going to fail that 100 jump sequence quite regularly with a failure rate at 99%. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you get a save point after each check, you're almost never going to have a problem. Right? So those checkpoints and where the checkpoints come in and how they're used matters a lot in terms of the actual frustration of the game without necessarily impacting the difficulty, because it's a different scale. Difficulty and how the game punishes you for your failure are different ways of handling game difficulties.
This isn't quite on topic to what you're talking about, but I feel like it's relevant. One thing that has always been interesting to me is my own personal reaction to XCOM, which is XCOM is kind of notorious for making you care a lot about these soldiers that you gain experience, give custom gear to. You know, they've been through you through thick and thin through all these missions, and then all
they're
of
going
a sudden
to die.
They die. Yeah, they're going to die. And that's almost, you might almost say that's like the hook of the game, is that like it's a great game. It's one of my favorite games, the XCOM series. There's a lot of things to like about it, but one of the things that makes it really unique is that it takes these randomly generated characters, makes you care about them, and then kills them off through random chance and luck. And there are ways through a lot of the games to kind of, what's it called, save scum, right? Where, like, if you really want to do it, you can basically make it so that all of your characters never end up dying. And that sounds like a really dirty way to play the game, and it's certainly not the way that I would ever anticipate that I would play the game. And yet, when I play XCOM, my brain always finds a way to justify to myself, like, oh, come on, that person only had a 10% chance to miss that shot. And if I had made that shot, then, you know, this never would have happened. I'm just going to reload because the game is cheating me here. And I find a way to do that every single damn mission, to where throughout the entire game, I'll lose maybe two or three of my the guys they get emotionally attached to. The rookies that, you know, the newbies, they die off really quickly. But it's not something I'm proud of. I kind of hate myself for it, because I'm not playing the game the right way. And I feel like I'm cheating myself of the experience of, like, dealing with a challenge and, you know, suffering the emotional consequences of losing those characters. And yet I still do it. And I'm not sure how to deal with that, to be quite honest.
Well, and from a gameplay perspective, I only played the XCOM that was on Xbox. One of them.
Yeah, Enemy Unknown.
I think so. It sounds familiar. Yeah. I don't even know if I got emotionally attached to them, but it was more just the pure frustration of, you're at a certain point of the game, and then, like, you lose one or even two of your high-level characters. Then you got to start over with, like, level one newbies on this, like, high-level maps and everything. It was just, like, I didn't want to have to deal with that.
Yeah, and there's certainly a balancing act. I mean, you're supposed to be doing, and what the game tries to encourage you to do, is to have a deep roster and not necessarily a top-heavy one. So maybe you send off your best character, but then he gets injured and he's not available for the next mission. Well, you should always be kind of cycling in some other guys to get experience. But yeah, to your point, it is tough, because if you get your A team completely wiped out, you might be kind of boned, and you might not be able to come back from it. It's a brutal, unforgiving game.
Earth may not be saved.
It's one of the few. Yeah, it's one of the few brutal and unforgiving games that I actually kind of enjoy still in my old age, where I'm a classic gamer. That's why I like to phrase it. So those are the games that I've been playing lately. Anything else? Did I miss any categories? Anything else you guys want to touch on?
Well, we could just, I know I was the one to say we should toss them out, but we can just briefly say, like, it's kind of hard to find movies or even music nowadays with, you know, no movie theaters, obviously. And music, most of them have been been delayed.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Fiona Apple just released an album.
I actually was listening to it, so.
I listened to the first song and a half so far. That's all I managed to before the family came home. And I wasn't going to blast Fiona Apple with the kids around.
It's not my style of music, but it has some interesting things going on. She's definitely got her message and her talent there, so it's well worth listening to. But it's getting a lot of praise as, you know, the album of 2020, but I'm not sure I buy into that just yet.
Well, it almost is the album. So, you know, yeah, what I mean?
Like, no one else is putting anything else out.
Yeah, most people, because musicians make the bulk of their money, I think, all like concerts and all that stuff. So if you can't do a concert to support an album, they're kind of saying no. Like Lady Gaga, I know, is a big example of, she said she's delaying her album until everything is back to quote unquote normal. So she might be waiting a while.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the Academy Awards are like this year. With, yeah,
Trolls World Tour wins everything.
Yeah, I mean, will every movie that got released get a nomination? It might, maybe. Yeah. Okay, well, we're running a little long, so it seems like a good place to wrap up now. You know, check us out at rampantdiscourse.com. We have a Twitter handle at rampantdisc. We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/rampantdiscourse. You can join our Discord channel at discord.io/rampantdiscourse. Am I missing anything else? I think I hit all the high notes there. Leave us a review on iTunes or wherever else. Hope you guys are all staying safe, washing your hands, and hands up the discourse.